Actually, Connor Boyack has just phoned in. Connor, are you with us?
I am, Jake. How are you?
Doing great, man. Welcome to the show. So, the 9%, who is that?
The elusive 9%, the few, the deluded.
Does that have to do? Does that have to do with Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, there may be a little bit of correlation, but I'm doubting it. No, this is a new poll that came out. CBS just penned an article noting that Congress now has a 9% approval ratings. We are now officially in single digits. You know, they've been in the tank for a while, since decades ago when they had over 50%, upwards of 60-65. So for some time they've been in the low double digits, but now they're at 9%. And so it's kind of funny, there was an article that was just published this morning, I think on The Atlantic, and the guy was going around trying to ask people, you know, are you one of the 9% who approve of what Congress is doing? And he couldn't find anyone. He was asking at parties and asking on the elevator. And his kind of semi-sarcastic conclusion that he came to was it's the people who are feeding at the federal trough. It's all the, you know, employees and the staffers and those who are directly benefiting from what Congress is doing, whatever that may be, who, because of their own job security and connection to their wallet, claim that they approve of what Congress is doing so that they don't risk being let go to downsize or restructure.
Now, Connor, you are a scholar of liberty. You've now written a very popular book on liberty. Let me ask you a question then. What would you think if Thomas Jefferson heard that Congress had a 9% approval rating? What would he be up to right about now?
He would be saying that we need... he would be issuing... the 2011 version of what his radical statement back then was, and that was needing to water the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots. And whatever form that may look like in our day, I don't know, but this is certainly something that would not be tolerable to so many of the founding generation to see how bad. You know, for me, I look at it from a market perspective. In fact, my wife mentioned this to me today, and I think the point makes it very clear. You know, you go to Amazon.com, right, and you're looking around for, you know, maybe a book you want to buy or a shirt or what have you, and that one of the first things that catches your eye is the little five stars next to the product name.
Right.
You want to see what the rating is for that product. You want to see how many people collectively have created that average rating. And if you saw something that had, you know, a sliver of one star, you would just move on. You would not even consider it. You would not entertain the thought of acquiring that item. You would just laugh. Maybe you would read some of the comments, because sometimes you'll get some funny comments when a rating is that low that people so despise whatever product you're looking at. Why is or why should government be any different? Why do we tolerate a product, a government, that is so abysmal, so horrible, that even at 9%, we keep sending back and electing the same morons who are creating this massively low approval rating? It makes no sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective, because that's less than one half of one star on the five-star rating, that 9%.
Yeah. They would probably take it down out of their product listing on Amazon because it would reflect poorly on the store, you know? I mean, but I think there's actually a principle there, Jake, and that is, We often talk about market forces and commerce and all this stuff, and, you know, subjecting things to the market, letting people decide. Why should government be any different? You know, why does the state that claims the monopolistic authority to tax and coerce, why do we give that a pass? Why is it okay that we, you know, justify a government apparatus as it's currently structured that can do whatever it wants under the guise of whatever powers it claims? And we just keep taking it and saying, well, we are the government and we just need to elect better people and participate at the ballot box. These are kind of we're deluding ourselves, I think. We become the 9% by justifying and supporting the system itself as it currently exists that just perpetuates the very problem that we claim to be opposing.
So you know, at 9%, I mean, they really don't have the consent of the governed.
No.
I mean, we should just be like, you know, pardon my language, but screw it. I'm not listening to your dumb laws. Nobody wants to listen to that. At 9%, you're just, nobody's even happy.
Yeah, no, there should be some structural constitutional amendment that basically, you know, if Congress's collective approval rating falls below a certain limit, they're all fired and, you know, we go to special elections nationwide. This article, in fact, it was really funny. They provided several examples of things that have higher approval rating, like Paris Hilton has a 15% approval rating.
Oh my gosh. That, you know you're bad when Paris Hilton's got a higher approval rating than you do.
It's funny, right? Polygamy had like 11 or 12% approval rating. Like,
wow.
The thing that is criminalized and so despised by the public has a higher approval rating than Congress. The IRS has a an approval rating that's four times higher than Congress. How does that work? How is it that the despised IRS has a four times? It makes no sense. And so, you know, if polygamy is criminalized and has that low of an approval rating, maybe we need to say anything 15% and below is just outlawed. It's immediately against the law. You know, you're going to jail. That would immediately jail, you know, everyone in Congress. We'd probably have to make some exceptions for the few patriots that exist.
We'd let Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul and maybe Bernie Sanders out.
Yeah, so it just makes no sense. But again, I think the principle is why are we tolerating a government that does not operate, does not respond at all to market forces? Clearly, we don't want a government that, you know, through the popular whims of the people, that, you know, if they're creating all these socialist systems and printing money, and so they get majority support from people because all these people are benefiting from quote-unquote free money, that therefore they're manufacturing the consent of the governed or public support. So, you know, logistically and technically, you don't really want to do that, but why are we tolerating a government, though, that has no responsive mechanism at all to whether people support what they're doing? Now, the criticism would be, well, they do support it because they elected the person who is voting in a way that creates this approval rating. I just think we need to look inward a bit more and say, why are we doing this to ourselves? And who's responsible? Like, you know, it makes no sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous when they've got a 9% approval rating, yet they still have all the purse strings at their control. They can spend as much as they want.
Well, and I think it's easy for them to blame the other guys, too, right? They'll go home and they'll wrap all this emotional rhetoric around their bad voting record to justify to their constituency that, oh, I tried to vote for this and we supported this. They probably won't mention all the bad things that they also did that would, you know, contribute to that low approval rating. But it's always the other guy. It's always, you know, I'm in there fighting for you. And, you know, I mean, Orrin Hatch uses this rhetoric all the time to blame the liberal Democrats for, you know, all of our many woes, when he does not, of course, tell the whole picture, which, you know, myself and many others are doing for the GOP delegates and the public at large, and that is that most of his record is exacerbating the very problem that he claims to rail against.
Well, and this also speaks to, I think, the Tea Party, right? Because obviously back during midterms in 2010, people were sick and tired and fed up and not happy, and I'm sure approval ratings were at all-time lows then. I'm sure this 9% is an all-time record, but I'm sure they were disgusted then, and that's why this whole Tea Party thing happened. But almost invariably, the entire Tea Party has sold out, with the exception of, I think it was Rand Paul and Mike Lee and five others that actually voted no on this NDAA thing.
Right.
What in the heck, man? Like, how many times are we going to fall for the scam?
And I think the biggest issue that we have here, Jake, is a massive disconnect between problems and solutions. I think we as American people are generally pretty good at observing problems. Right, we know when things are messed up, when Congress is screwing around, when the government's bad, when we've taxed and spent and gone into debt too much. I think generally we're pretty good at saying that's a problem. I think we collectively are horrible when it comes to understanding, implementing, and applying the right solutions. I mean, you look at, you know, you mentioned the Tea Party, for example. The fact that, like, clowns such as you know, what's his name? Pizza guy.
Kane?
Kane.
Yeah. Pizza guy.
I already forgot his name. He became so relevant.
999.
The fact that Kane and Newt Gingrich, and even now Mitt Romney with the Nikki Haley endorsement, the fact that these clowns are getting any type of Tea Party support whatsoever is very indicative, I think, of the inability of so many people, even the Tea Party constitutionalist, freedom-loving patriots, to find the right solution. They're good at saying the government is too big. The problem comes in the solution.
Yeah, well, when we come back after the break, we're bumping against our break here. We're in the middle of the Boyack Review. Let's talk about that, Connor, that disconnect between problems and solutions. What maybe you think some of these solutions might be that we could head down and maybe fix this problem right here on K-Talk, AM 630. All right, guys, Mental Self-Defense Radio. I am Jake Shannon. We are on the line with Connor Boyack. Connor, before the break, we were talking about The 9% that somehow, the elusive 9% that I can't even believe it's as high as 9%, but that somehow approve of Congress, meaning that 91% do not approve, which right. totally makes sense to me. But we were talking about this, you brought up this point about the disconnect between problems that we're great at complaining but not so good at fixing the problem. Where do you think we can go with that now that that you've kind of diagnosed that? What would you say is next?
Well, you know, for most people, I think they say the ballot box is the answer. We need to vote out the bad people, vote in the good people. As controversial as this may sound, I think it's probably also in the public interest to have certain people stay home and not go to the ballot box at all. I mean, the fact that you get these people who just vote down the party line, or they, you know, base their decision off of, you know, one campaign ad that they saw, or a mailer that they got.
Oh, Sarah Palin is hot, and so I'm going to vote for her.
Yeah, or, you know, Mitt Romney is Mormon like me, or whatever. You know, these types of people, clearly there's not going to be any legitimate institutionalization, you know, or requirement of you need to be this smart and understand what you believe this much before voting. There's really no way to enforce it, but I think we would be better off if a large percent of the voting bloc simply did not participate in the process, because, you know, they're definitely not contributing. But for them and for everyone, I mean, the answer always comes down to education and opening people's eyes to understand the principles of liberty and the consistency of their application. So when I wrote my book, for example, one of the biggest problems that I saw was, from my vantage point, inconsistency. People would claim to support the Constitution, but then they would support the war on drugs and federal immigration laws.
Yeah, that drives me nuts to no end.
And it's inconsistency. And for many people, honestly, it's that they simply have not challenged their own assumptions and biases, and they haven't gotten to the point where they consider every single political issue. And when, for many people who are sincere and open to discussion, I've, you know, persuaded many people to realize the inaccuracy of their previous inconsistency, and then they become more consistent. And so I think, you know, not only is the 91% hate Congress, or disapprove, I should say, of Congress, not only is the 91% probably really good at seeing the problem and understanding how bad things are, I think that they collectively really probably, you know, the majority of people say that they love liberty, that they support the Constitution and freedom. But the problem comes in understanding what those terms really are and how they apply specifically to issues. Not only the issues themselves, but then having a healthy skepticism and kind of an initial distrust of politicians, right? Because the politician might say, well, I support this issue, or I'm going to vote this way. But that's a whole other paradigm that you need to be very resistant to, kind of these guys peddling snake oil and trying to get you to just support them so they can acquire some power. It's a game. It's a nasty game, and I think people just need to better understand how much is at risk and what's involved, and it all just boils down to getting the right education, not like a school-based education. I'm not saying go get a degree, but just having your eyes open to things as they really are and understanding that it's so easy to be deceived, I think, in this, that you need to kind of build up a tolerance and have a little bit of experience. I think then is when you're going to be able to have kind of a critical eye to the government, to politicians, and be able to make more informed decisions.
Excuse me. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it really was, for me, when I moved here originally, like about the end of 2008, early 2009, Chaffetz was getting all this great press, and, you know, he's doing these great things, and I thought, oh, he's a great guy. And then I started to actually dig a little deeper, and I was like, whoa, man, this is just not consistent here. These are some serious problems. He's good on a few things, but then, you know, the other 91%, there's some very serious issues here. But, yeah, you're right. People don't dig that deep. They don't have a consistent philosophical approach. So one solution you're saying is education, and not only an education in terms of a principled view, but also how maybe people learning how to vet their representatives better, maybe?
Yeah, I just think understanding the nature of the beast, right? Understanding the history of what Congress has done, that even in the good times a few decades ago when Congress had a 65% approval rating, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were doing the right things and passing good laws, because they weren't, right? It just means that people were getting their pensions and gas was cheap and, you know, like economically people were comfortable enough that they didn't have a critical eye to government, whereas right now when people are really hurting and you've got Occupy Wall Street, going on and all these people complaining because they're homeless and being foreclosed on and losing jobs, then people say, oh, well, it's the government's fault, therefore, you know, now we're going to be all worried and cranky about it. But the approval rating comes and goes, and it'll ebb and flow as people feel that they're getting the benefits that they want from government. The question is, you know, is government doing the right thing? Is it structured correctly? Is it legitimately and morally empowered to do what it is doing? These are things that I think, you know, I go back to this story quite often, and I think it's a very telling one. John Adams and Tom Paine were kind of arch nemeses. And Tom Paine was really good at tearing things down, right? He was a good pamphleteer. He would criticize the crown quite well. And he was really known for tearing down the government. But John Adams really despised Tom Paine when it came time for solutions, because he did not like what Tom Paine was proposing in lieu of what he was criticizing in terms of what a new government should be formed and what it should do. And John Adams saw himself as the edifier, the constructor, and he wanted to be able to propose and talk about these solutions and felt that he was good at it. I think that we need those two characteristics in the same person. Right. I mean, in that case, there were different people. One was a destroyer, one was a builder. But I think the best political activist, the best change agent that we can have in government is someone who understands what should not exist and what should exist in its place. That we can, in the same sentence, be able to point to a flaw in government and you know, illustrate what is happening but should not be happening, but then also propose a solution. And because I think it's really easy, again, to get people to agree with you and say, we shouldn't be doing this. Well, yeah, okay, great. But, you know, what are we going to do about it? What should we be doing instead? And us being able to constructively provide examples, even if they're dismissed as idealist and, you know, unrealistic, we need to be able to provide the 91% of people who see the problem a solution that they can understand, that's reasonable, that there's an underlying principle they can be persuaded about. I think us who are trying to promote liberty, rather than just pointing out flaws, myself included, you know, we need to be better at proposing alternative solutions that people can understand and agree with.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% because, you know, it is both the artist and the art critic that they both have certain roles, and those roles might change over time. I mean, obviously, we needed somebody like Tom Paine to wake people up to the tyranny of George III and all that, but you're right, maybe he wasn't the best social architect once he'd helped destroy the existing kind of paradigm. You know, I'm curious, and you know, I don't mean to maybe catch you off guard or anything, but what is your view with regards to, you know, electoral reform, in the sense that, you know, one of the things that I'm really kind of from more of my math background and a little bit of me being a fan of public choice economics is this idea of, you know, like the fair vote. I don't know if you've been to fairvote.org or anything like that, but actually changing from this first-past-the-post voting system, where obviously the outcomes are just suboptimal, to, you know, maybe like an instant runoff type of voting or proportional representation. Have you looked into any of that?
Yeah, I have, and it's, in fact, one of the big things that's going on right now as you talk about electoral reform is electoral college reform, the method by which we select a president. There's a huge initiative that's going on countrywide called the National Popular Vote, and it's basically is changing the structure and circumventing the electoral college to be able to award a state's delegates to a presidential candidate based on, you know, majority vote of the citizens within each given state. So there's several legislators in Utah that support it. I think there's going to be a bill in this session that aims to change it. Many other states have introduced legislation or passed legislation. It's gaining steam, and I think it's dangerous. I think that, you know, the founders were wise to create the Electoral College that gives smaller states with smaller populations a larger influence. Otherwise, you know, all of the presidential candidates are simply going to go to the states that have the most population. And
yeah, like
delegates.
Everybody will be campaigning in California and in New York or something.
Right, and that's exactly right. As for the fair vote and things like that, I'm a bit more radical in that if we're going to spend our political energy trying to tweak the method of voting, for me the question is not how should we vote within the system that exists. It's, is the system that exists legitimate? Right, and it gets back to my question at the beginning of market forces in government. When I look at every other and perhaps not every other. I'm sure there's some that are different, but almost every other institution and organization, they're voluntary. You affiliate with them independent of where you live, in terms of your specific property. Maybe there are different chapters in different cities, but if you're a member of the Rotary Club or the Boy Scouts or a church congregation or what have you, these are all voluntary organizations. They have codes of conduct and bylaws and membership fees and all of that, but you choose to affiliate with them and then gain from the whatever services that they offer or whatever benefits that you receive as a result of your membership. Government doesn't operate that way at all. Government is a monopolistic, mandatory, we own you and govern you and have jurisdiction over you simply because you've acquired property within this geographical boundary. There is no option to voluntarily associate or disassociate. You cannot give your consent. You can give, some would argue, implicit consent by buying property in an area where they claim jurisdiction, but is that jurisdiction ever legitimate to begin with? Can nine neighbors govern the tenth simply because that tenth person is their neighbor? Can they claim the authority over those who live around them simply because they live around them? I don't know that that is a legitimate function and power of government. And when I talk about market forces being reintroduced to government, that the idea is have competing governments, have overlapping governments, have governments that have to respond to the market forces in the sense that if they are, you know, in the case of Congress, if we had, you know, different congresses and different federal governments that we could affiliate with, if this one had a 9% approval rating but another one had 53, then the one that's 9% and messing up would respond as they do in the private, as we do in the private market, and would have to either shape up or they would lose clientele and the other government would benefit and receive more fees and tax dollars and be able to better sustain itself. So I think, you know, it's clearly a radical change, but I think if we're going to talk about all these things that we're going to expend all this political energy on, let's maybe talk about something that has a bit more of a legitimate foundation to it, and that is getting government to respond to market forces so that when a Congress has a 9% approval rating, it's not just a laughable subject for an afternoon radio segment, but rather something that compels people to change their behavior, affiliate or unaffiliate with that government, and spark some real change rather than just commentary.
Yeah, you know, you talk about competing governments and whatnot, and I think a lot of people, it boggles their mind that that the market could take care of some of these things. But, you know, what I look at, first of all, back in the day, all the fire departments were like volunteer fire departments, and then they would, you know, have overlapping jurisdictions, and one would get there before the other. But look at ambulatory services right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's not owned by the state. Ambulances are their own independent companies, and they respond to the scene of a crime or to an accident or whatever, and they are there. They're the first responders, and there's no problem. That's totally market driven, and then, you know, you either pay for it or you can't pay for it, and they put you in collections or whatever. But as a business, they're able to operate and, you know, maintain customer satisfaction. I can't see any problem with that. The trick is like you said, education, getting people to wrap their head around possibly user fees that are voluntary instead of actually you get coconutted over the head with a baton if you don't pay.
Right, and yeah, and that it boils down to the voluntary association, true consent of the governed. You know, people talk about, well, we have this social contract. I never signed a contract. You know, where are the terms listed in this social contract? But when you have these competing governments and a voluntary association with these governments, you are explicitly giving a contract. Every adult would be able to affiliate or unaffiliate with whatever available government in their area that they wanted to or did not want to. It's a very radical idea, very different from what we have today. But when we talk about the morality and legitimacy of government, so many people assume that the state as it exists today is justified, and therefore, well, how should we vote and how should we participate? But I like to ask a more fundamental question, that is the state legitimate? Can an institution compel the individuals who live within, quote-unquote, its jurisdiction to do as it pleases simply on majority vote? We often talk about, well, republic, not a democracy, but when it boils down to it, we are all a democracy. We are all subject to the whims of the masses.
Voting, yeah.
Right, and our neighbors can vote away our wallets even while we claim that we're a republic. And so by changing that to a system where I have explicitly agreed to affiliate with that government, at any time that they vote away or pass a law or whatever that I don't like, I simply unaffiliate, again, taking into account the pros and cons that maybe if I unaffiliate and I don't affiliate with the government, then there is no institution that I have available that will protect my my property and my person. There's no one that will come to my aid if my fire, if my house, lights up on fire. You take that into account, but right now, short of moving and getting rid of all your property and leaving family and friends behind, you know, we have no option.
Yeah, I agree. We do need to keep an eye towards solutions. Keep identifying the problems, but keep an eye towards solutions. Hey, Connor, great segment. Thank you, as always, my friend.
Thank you.
Guys, come on back.